and welcome to Worlds Apart. Great, greater, the greatest. The Trump administration isn't shy about touting its achievements on the domestic or global stage, but putting aside self-adulation, what structural influence does it have on great power politics around the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Rajat Ganguly, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Asian Security and International Affairs. Dr. Ganguly, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. Now, every time there's a discussion about the great power rivalry, we hear words like concern, worry, apprehension. John Mearsheimer used the word tragedy in his seminal book on the subject. Why is it so negative? Do you think the reality of great power politics in general or in the current historical moment, does it warrant such an anxiety-driven approach?
Well, historically, if you look at international relations for the last 250, 300 years, most of the major wars have happened between great powers. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. And international politics has been dominated by great power politics. There is no a priori reason why great powers can't cooperate. We have had instances when great powers cooperate, we get very good outcomes. And there's a line of thinking which suggests that great powers should be able to cooperate. But unfortunately, there are more instances when great powers, having seen eye to eye, they cannot cooperate. They pursue sometimes unilateral, interest-driven policies. And as a result, they clash. And when they clash, the consequences are devastating for the world. Let me also say that my own view is that given the current reality of great power politics, given that great powers are incredibly powerful in terms of being able to cause harm to others. My own view is that great powers should not directly, enter into conflict. So can you imagine a war between US and Russia or US and China? Even a limited war would be devastating for the world, right?
Dr. Ganguly, you're making a responsibility sort of argument, and I totally agree with you. They, by the nature of them being great or calling themselves great, they have to behave like adults. But unfortunately, the reality of modern day politics is not normative. It's not just realpolitik, but it's a very childish realpolitik, is it not?
Sometimes it is. It depends on, who you get as leaders. I mean, my impression is that President Xi Jinping or President Putin are incredibly mature leaders. But then when you are matched up with people on the other side who, for whatever reason, do not want to behave in a mature fashion, do not want to, behave in a responsible fashion, as you use the word responsible. Then what do you get? Then you get, terrible outcomes sometimes. And this has been a problem because you can't control who you're going to get as leaders and what their motivations are. Who are they sort of, beholden to, what kind of agenda they are pushing. These are all important questions, right?
Absolutely. Now, one hallmark of a great power politics is that each player has their own very distinct way of throwing their weight around, or to use more formal language, their own unique way of engaging both with the world and with other great powers. And I think it's also about the power, the balance of power, not necessarily external, but internal balance of power. How much power you apply right now, in what form, and how does it play with your strategic goals down the line? Because if you're too strict or too rigid right now, or too offensive right now, then it may hurt you, a few years down the line. Now, if you look at the current composition of power around the world, which nation do you think practices power in the most sophisticated way that takes into account the current realities, but also has a somewhat strategic view?
Well, it depends on how you define, what is sophisticated. My impression is that we have gone through various stages in international relations over the last 75, 80 years. So during the long Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States, there was this very tacit understanding between the two superpowers that we must not engage in direct conflict. There were some rules of the game that was established. And all of that came to an end in the early 90s, as you know, with the collapse of communism and the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. And this then created a 30-year roughly period when American hegemony was dominant. And this hegemonic system is now coming to an end because other great powers are now emerging, particularly Russia, China, India, etc. And what I would say we are witnessing right now is one side which desperately wants to hold on to hegemony at any cost. And then you have the other great powers who are aspiring to become great powers. And one of the hallmarks of great powership, you know, when you become a great power, one of the characteristics of that is you don't want to be bullied around by other great powers. You don't want others to tell you how you should behave, right? So in other words, when this dust settles, when this transition takes place fully, you know, some kind of a sphere of influence kind of thing will have to be worked out. The Chinese would say East Asia, Southeast Asia, our area. So, you know, we will call the shots here. India might say the same thing with South Asia, Indian Ocean. Russia clearly is putting out the marker saying, you know, no NATO expansion into Ukraine. You know, you can't come any further towards Russia, etc. You know, if you try to do that, then there'll be pushback. And America will have to come to terms. And I think Professor Jeffrey Sachs actually has talked about this in a very major way, that America would have to become a Western hemispheric power instead of a global power. Is that something that's going to sit very nicely with the U.S.? Probably not. But what's the alternative?
Absolutely. I think it's also about the limits of your own power and your own possibilities for your own sake. And I think we all as adults have to contend with that at some point in our individual lives. And the same applies to countries as well. Now, let me ask you something, because we are recording this interview on a day when the leaders of the United States and China are expected to meet in South Korea. We still don't know the outcome of their talks, but it has been reported that their advisors have met beforehand and that they have worked out some sort of a deal that is supposed to put an end or reduce the risk, at least, of an all-out global trade war. First of all, do you think that's likely to happen?
Well, I don't know enough to be able to say whether it will happen or not, because this is still an unfolding situation. I'm hearing that Trump will be in South Korea and, you know, there's a possibility he will meet one-to-one with Xi Jinping. I hope he does. I hope, you know, they talk sense with each other, because what we are witnessing actually, Oksana, for the first time after 1945, is actually America now dismantling the neoliberal free trade, global trade agreement that was gradually created after 1945, which no American president actually wanted to destroy. I think the Trump people are, you know, on the path towards that. And I hope better sense prevails. And, you know, as the Chinese prime minister said the other day, that, you know, this zero-sum type, you know, unilateral, self-destructive type of policies are not helpful for anybody. It won't even help America in the long run. And therefore, if a meeting takes place, if an understanding is reached, I think we'll have to accept that. And we'll have to say, that's better than a no-holds-barred trade conflict. And God knows, you know, what other conflicts it will lead to.
I just heard one of the experts here in Russia compare what's going on between China and the United States to a very complicated divorce between a highly influential couple that has accumulated a lot of wealth, that has a lot of sort of interlinkages. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the two people that hate each other, that have very little trust towards each other, and who ultimately want to grab as much as possible for themselves and leave their partner absolutely empty-handed. Do you agree with such analogy?
I kind of agree. And when you mentioned almost like a movie, you know, I'm reminded of that Hollywood film called War of the Roses. I don't know whether you've seen it. And you know, what a bitter divorce actually can look like, and, you know, how petty the fight can become. So in a sense, probably, you know, something like that is happening. But I think one thing I would say is that the Chinese are now so confident about their own power capability that they're not going to take a backward step in this conflict. And for that matter, you know, neither would Russia, nor would India, nor would anybody else, I mean, who has any semblance of self-respect.
But Dr. Ganguly, is divorce really possible given the fact that we live on one planet? I mean, are we really talking about divorce or perhaps decoupling or perhaps some sort of arrangement that will have them cooperate in some shape or form?
Well, it'll be a gradual step, Oksana. I mean, for example, there was some discussion in the context of the BRICS gathering, for example. You know, you saw the Kazan meeting of BRICS. There was some talk that there has to be a complete rupture with the Western-dominated economic order. And that means, you know, creating an alternative to the SWIFT system, a global currency of BRICS, et cetera, et cetera. I think that would be a very, very drastic step at this time. So I don't know whether we will head towards that, but maybe eventually we will, because already, you know, there's pressure on the dollar. I mean, a lot of countries are trading in local currencies and not the dollar. But on the other hand, I think America will also have to realize that its ability to push people around, push everybody around, and you know, if it doesn't get its way, it's going to impose sanctions. If sanctions don't work, then it will change regime. If that doesn't work, it's going to drop bombs on people's head. I mean, that kind of approach also is going to be counterproductive, particularly with these rising great powers like China, like Russia, like India. So this trade talk, I think Trump will have to show a lot of flexibility with Xi Jinping, and maybe they'll come to, you know, as the Chinese said yesterday, you know, this has to be sort of 50-50 on both sides. You know, you have to give up something, we have to give up something, you know, let's meet in the middle, something like that.
Dr. Ganguly, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Do you ever catch yourself questioning more?
Like, why do I always parrot everything the U.S. State Department says?
Or why I always ask, do you condemn Hamas, but never Israel?
Why I never said sorry for spreading the debunked Trump-Russiagate hoax?
Why I support every illegal war the U.S. has launched this century?
Why I can't stop lying that Joe Biden was young and healthy enough for the presidency?
Why we ignore our rock-bottom ratings and pretend people still want to watch the same old bullshit?
The only reason we're asking
is because RT generated this video
and made us do it.
So you'll never get answers, at least not from us.
Happy anniversary to RT. I may be an AI, but there's no way I'm saying that.
This is it, Moscow. And you know why I'm here? Because when somebody tells me that I cannot report something, it's my nature as a journalist to question why. Why can you tell Ukraine's side of the story, but you can't tell Russia's side of the story? That would be a half-truth. You know another way of saying half-truth? A lie. When Washington or London or whoever tells me I'm not allowed to tell the truth, you know what I do? The opposite. I shine a light on it. That is the Sanchez Effect. And I'm Rick Sanchez. Look for it.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Rajat Ganguly, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Asian Security and International Affairs. Dr. Ganguly, before the break, you said that China is feeling increasingly confident about its ability not only push back, but respond to the United States in a measured way. And I think what we've seen so far in this tariff standoff is China not only holding its ground, but actually, you know, turning the screws on the United States, both with the controls on the exports of rare earth minerals and also stopping buying the Chinese soybeans. At the same time, we see the Chinese negotiators being willing to engage, and they played their part in flattery politics, saying that the American negotiators were pretty tough. So I wonder if that's ultimately the hallmark of a new Chinese style, when they are pursuing their goals pretty diligently, but at the same time, without necessarily humiliating their opponent or claiming victory over it.
No, I think I agree. I mean, you're right. I mean, you know, a mature diplomacy would be like that, you know, you don't want to say nasty things to the other side, because at the end of the day, you're looking to make a deal with them. You know, you have to coexist with them. But why single out China? I think if China's diplomacy has been mature, so has been Russia's diplomacy, so has been India's diplomacy. I mean, look at the abuse India has taken from the United States in the last, you know, month or two. And did Modi react in a nasty way? Did, you know, Jaishankar react in a nasty way? No. I mean, you know, they're still saying nice things about the U.S. They're still discussing trade. They're still talking about other things. But that's what mature countries do, right? So if you take the view that I'm going to, you know, be nasty to the other side, then how do you even, you know, get past the first hurdle in having a discussion with them and a complex discussion with them? And even on America's side, that the language has become better now, because my own reaction was that, you know, the kind of language they were using against India were terrible. I mean, if you're trying to come and make a deal with India, then this is not the kind of language you use. I mean, language like, you know, we have got to fix India, we have got to fix Brazil. I mean,
but you know, Dr. Ganguly, this is precisely why I wanted to single out China, because while other countries can react in a pretty rhetorical and straightforward way, I think China is perhaps unique in its capacity to approach the confrontation with the United States strategically. And what I mean by that is that, for example, when they introduce controls on rare earth minerals, it's not just about any other commodity. It's not just tit for tat, because the Americans need Chinese rare earth to develop their own high-tech industry, including military industry. So it's not only about the product. It's also about your ability to develop, you know, industries on which the entire U.S. power is based right now. Do you think the Chinese have the potential of expanding this sort of way of keeping the United States in check, but not by rhetoric, not by public gestures, but rather by, you know, quiet policy that will lead to the change in the American behavior?
Yeah, I think so. Look, I mean, you know, US and China, it is unmistakable that they both need each other. And you pointed out that the U.S. needs Chinese rare earths. You know, China needs access to the U.S. market. So both sides understand it. And I think this pressure point, you know, if the Americans are putting pressure on China by imposing tariff, the Chinese would impose pressure on America by, you know, stopping rare earths, for example. Eventually, both realize that we will compromise and we'll come to some kind of agreement. But that agreement has to be between two equal sides. I think America's attitude has been, or at least Trump's attitude has been, in my estimation, that this is a negotiation between unequals, and I'm going to bully you to the point that you will then cave in and say, yeah, you know, whatever you want, I'll give you. Just don't hurt me so much with tariffs. And to some extent, he's actually got that in Southeast Asia. I mean, if you look at some of the deals they have done with Japan and you know, with Indonesia and others, a little bit of American bullying has actually worked with these countries. But my sense is it won't work with the big countries. It won't work with China, won't work with India. It is not working with Brazil, which is why they're talking about now, you know, fixing Brazil. And certainly it has not worked with Russia. I mean, you are in Russia, you know what the story is with Ukraine and, you know, what has happened over the last 3-4 years, right?
Absolutely. I agree with you on the fact that actually we have two versions of Trump. Trump, when he's talking to a leader of a great power that he knows can respond forcefully, there is one version of him. And then when he talks to, you know, a country which he is perhaps ignorant or dismissive about, then he presents a totally different face of Trump. Now, speaking about the influence of great power politics, now that China has demonstrated a certain way of dealing with the United States, and perhaps Russia also demonstrated its own way of dealing with the Western military expansion. Do you think other nations may take notice and perhaps, if not copy, then take some of that into account? Or is it a case of what's allowed to Caesar is not allowed to the bull?
No, I think other countries are looking at it. And look, I mean, you know, if you think of Russia as a civilizational state, China is a civilizational state, India is a civilizational state. You know, these countries, as they are not just great powers, but they, you know, they firmly believe that they are, you know, they represent a long-standing civilization going back 3,000, 4,000 years, right? So there's a tremendous amount of self-respect involved in this. So it is not just power politics. It is also about who you are, what you represent. And America, probably first time in a long time, is now realizing that I'm not going to get my way by trying to bully these countries, you know, any longer. They are now at a position when they won't be, you know, nasty towards me, perhaps. But on the other hand, if I expect that, you know, I will say jump and they will jump, that's not going to happen. There will be pushback if I try playing, you know, nasty politics with them. You know, this pressure on India, for example, that you cannot buy Russian oil. You know, did it work? I don't think so. You know, did India make a huge fuss about it? No, because that's not what mature countries do. But in terms of behavior, what has changed? You tell me, nothing has changed. So these Trump guys basically have probably realized that, you know, we can't push countries like India or Brazil or Russia or China around anymore. And increasingly, there'll be more countries like this. You know, I would imagine Iran would be, you know, one such country at some point. And increasingly, you know, if you can't do it on your own, I mean, you'll come together as a group and then, you know, you will resist that. And that's what we are witnessing. So the Chinese are not doing anything extraordinarily different compared to what the Russians have done or what the Indians have done.
They are doing that in their own special way, leveraging the advantages that they have. And they have an economic leverage. Russia has a military leverage, and it's doing that part on itself. By the way, what do you think is a distinct feature about the Indian approach to great power politics? What can India leverage to not only press its case, but also influence how things are done in the world?
Well, India has tremendous leverage in terms of its economic potential. You know, by prediction is by 2047, when India celebrates 100 years, India probably would overtake the United States and be the, you know, second largest economy in the world. It is already the largest in terms of population. A country with tremendous natural resources. It is fast becoming the manufacturing hub of the world, an alternative to China. I was very pleased to see these agreements that were announced between India and Russia about, you know, building commercial airliners, you know, all the kinds of military cooperation that's happening. So India has got, don't forget, the demographic dividend, that it has got a population, 50% of which is below the age of 35, and highly educated population. So in many labor-deficient countries, in many countries where, you know, there's a serious problem of aging. So Japan, for example, Japan is now encouraging Indians to come and work in Japan. If you go to Europe, you will find Indians in almost every country. And somebody told me the other day, even in the United States, even though Trump has gone after the Indians, I think sense has prevailed, that if they kick out the Indians from the United States, you know, their entire health industry will collapse, because 20% of doctors and nurses in the U.S. are Indians. Their, you know, high-tech, you know, computer type of industry will collapse or move from the United States to other parts of the world. Because these engineers, you know, IT engineers are Indians. So these are things that India will leverage, of course.
Okay. Now, can I ask you, perhaps that's going to be my last question. You mentioned a moment ago that all great powers opposing the United States in various ways have a sort of civilizational heritage or civilizational mentality to them. And ironically enough, the United States is also a civilizational power. Maybe they do not consider themselves as such, but in the way they behave, in the way they try to push their values onto others, there is a sort of a tinge of that. And the American policy...
How can you say America is a... I disagree. I don't think America is a civilizational state at all. I mean, how old is America? You know, 300 odd years? When you're comparing, you know, India, you know, at least 5,000, 6,000 years old, China like that, Russia like that, even Germany like that, you know, if you take...
Absolutely, but like psychologically, omnipotence is a quality that we have in our very early childhood. So maybe that's the reason for why the Americans are behaving this way. But my question to you is this. At this point of time, the American policy is characterized by a lot of unpredictability, a lot of chaotic or ignorant behavior. And we can put it on rather mercurial nature of Donald Trump. Do you expect, though, the United States to continue in the same vein after he's gone? Or do you expect perhaps a more stately or orderly, polite behavior?
That's a very interesting question, and it will require a very complex answer. Probably we don't have time for that. But I'll just refer to one thing. There was a recent interview of Steve Bannon by The Economist magazine, in which he suggested that Trump would become president again in 2028. That he will have a third term. And he said, you know, we have to take control of institutions. So this is very alarming kind of rhetoric, right? That they're going to change the 22nd Amendment. You know, maybe Trump will have a third term. There's that.
Even if that happens, I mean, he is not, you know, his life has a certain limit. He is not...
Of course. And he probably had suffered a stroke from what I'm hearing, that there was a... 6-day, you know, period when nobody knew where he was. He was in Walter Reed Hospital, apparently. Could have suffered a stroke. I don't know. But he looks very, you know, his face looks pretty tired to me for some reason, all of a sudden. And he's on a very, very, you know, he's not patient anymore. I mean, look at how he reacted to, you know, when President Putin refused to have the ceasefire agreement. You know, he got angry and he said, you know, I don't like it. And now, you know, he's talking about giving Tomahawk cruise missiles to Ukraine, etc. So I have a feeling that there is no proper, you know, strategy in the White House. I mean, things are happening at random. It's very hard to predict, you know, who has got the ear of the president, who is he listening to. You know, we know certain things that he doesn't read his briefs, for example. So who are the people who are advising him, you know, who are controlling him? Who are the people who are providing money? I mean, you have a U.S. government shutdown at the moment, right? And there was a report in the New York Times that some private, you know, financier of Trump is going to pay salaries of the U.S. military. I mean, this is as ludicrous as things have become. Then you have these, you know, woke, anti-woke type of cultural politics in the United States, which probably will have some effect. And there's a demographic transition in the U.S. There was a recent article by Minhas Merchant in an Indian newspaper, which talked about how the fear of losing white dominance in the U.S. is driving American politics. Very, very interesting argument. So, what I'm trying to suggest is that, you know, there will be turmoil domestically in the United States, and many of these politicians will react in ways that would be a little bit unpredictable at this time. But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, Dr. Ganguly, I totally agree with you. It's going to be fascinating to watch it, especially from a safe distance. In the meantime, thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, and lovely talking to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.